podcast this week, we're joined by the star of their finest. Yes, it's our finest. Gemma Arterton's going to be in the pod booth, plus all the usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast. It got 2 hours sleep last night and is fading pretty fast. Need a shot of adrenaline. Quick to the Thor Ragnarok trailer. Whew, that did it. Hello, pod. I'm a sleep-deprived Chris Hewitt, and welcome to the Emperor Podcast, which this week is brought to you by those mustard peeps at mustard.co.uk who do cool stuff with insurance comparison and whatnot. Check out their website at mustard.co.uk in case you hadn't already guessed. This week, Helen is still away. She's actually on the other side of the world now. She's about to embark upon this crazy running expedition, running 100 miles across mountains and things, being people are going to be throwing snakes at her. It's going to be awful. So she's been doing that for the next 10 days or so over in Nepal, and you can sponsor her. She's got a Just Giving page or something, Virgin Money page, fundraising page. She's fundraising for the NSPCC. So if you want to go on that page, it's on the internet.
I don't have
the URL to hand. I didn't write it down. I'm just riffing in this bit. But anyway, Helen's away. She's doing something amazing for charity. So if you want to sponsor.
If you Google Helen gone to Nepal, probably won't be back. Yetis. That'll come up.
That would be appreciated. So in Helen's absence, we've upped the sausage stakes. I'm now joined by three colleagues of such lethal cunning as we head into this Easter weekend. First up is our art house guru, a man who's going to spend the weekend hunting for Easter eggs in Werner Herzog's movies, because apparently if you pause it at the right moment in Fitzcarraldo, you can see the yawning maw of pointlessness that is the human existence. Is that right, Phil Disimlian?
I believe that is correct.
That is correct.
It's true.
Also,
you can see a little RTD2. No, you can't. That's stupid. How are you? You all right?
Good, well. Good. Yeah.
You glad to be
why
back?
Why are you so tired?
I don't know why I'm so tired. I was out late last night.
I got in
and I didn't get to sleep until 2 o'clock, and then I woke up at 4 o'clock and I couldn't get back to sleep after
hitting
that.
The tiles as you do.
I had three cokes last night. And I'm cutting out my Coke consumption. And say this, not a media wanker version of Coke. This is actual Coca-Cola. I drink a lot of it.
Yep.
And I'm running.
Yeah. Yes.
Now these
things
days
are changing.
And I'm changing my diet slowly, and I'm cutting out the Coke. And so last night I had quite a few, and I think the adrenaline surged through me.
You resisted a trip to McDonald's yesterday as well, which I was very impressed by.
You've changed, man.
Yeah.
I saw you bouncing coins off your pecs. I saw you.
It's like, where do I begin and the rock ends? But enough of that fan fiction.
It's an alarming image.
We've started already. Next up, you just heard him, is our other resident Dissemblian. He's a Jurassic Park nut and Jurassic World star, as he never tires of reminding us. He's going to spend the weekend trying to get some interesting eggs to hatch. But you know what? You're never going to find a raptor in the Smarties Easter egg. Nick Dissemblian, how are you?
Do you know what my favourite colour Smartie is? Blue. Because blue's a raptor. It's genuinely good.
Blue, of course, is your co-star in Jurassic World.
Can neither confirm nor deny. Oh, the film is out. Yeah.
Oh, dear.
Any more questions?
Via his
publicist.
Yeah, don't look Nick in the eyes, whatever you do. Don't worry, his vision's based on movement, so we should be fine. And last but not least, we're joined by someone. We were talking about this beforehand, weren't we? John Nugent. That you don't really have a defined podcast persona.
I'm without any personality.
Yeah, you were utterly bereft of characteristics.
I'm totally generic.
You're a very dull man.
I'm incredibly boring.
Yeah.
I thought you were the career crusher.
Yeah, but that ran out of steam fairly quickly. Then you became, I was away for a week, and you became some sort of entity.
How has that run out of steam? But our ones just rumble on indefinitely. Ours ran out of steam a long time ago.
So this is your chance.
Well,
rage-fueled career killer.
I want to stake a claim as Empire's rock correspondent, which I know Nick kind of had a bit of a territory over recently, but I went to Hawaii.
Nick's just put down the script for Jurassic World 2 and he's suddenly in the game now. He's like, his radar's on.
Come on. It's going to be a rumble. Yeah, the thing is, The Rock has tweeted both of us, right?
He has, but he tweeted to say that I was his bud.
Yeah.
And I felt that was a real olive branch of friendship.
You may be right, because I feel like I've had a falling out with The Rock.
Yeah, I think...
Our relationship soured, because I made a reference to Thunderwear. But I spelt it like lightning and thunder.
Yeah,
and he corrected me. He corrected me very publicly, and said it was fun to wear FUN. And it's been deafening silence since then.
Well, I
candy ass.
I think I'm a candy ass.
The Rock gave me a bottle of tequila. He bequeathed me a bottle of his favourite tequila, which I took as a token of, you know, the inner circle of Rock.
You're the new Sean William Scott. In many ways.
Are you expecting a cameo in Fast and Furious 9? Not saying, of course, that he survives Fast and Furious 8.
Sure.
You know, leaving it on the table.
I'm still hoping for a sequel to Journey to the Mysterious Island. I think that's one of The Rock's more undervalued early works.
It's on his IMDb page. Journey 3 the Moon, isn't it called? It's called Journey 2 the Moon, but with a number 2, even though it's the third film.
What?
I don't know.
Journey. Where would the 3 be in that? Would that be in Journey? Because it's the only word in that that has... Oh, the Lee has...
Live 3 or Die Moon. he's on his IMDb page. He's doing another one of those.
Is that actually happening?
Yeah, yeah.
Is that real?
I think so.
Will there be giant bees again? Will he ride a giant bee?
Okay.
And a tiny ukulele.
All right, so you're The Rock correspondent for the time being. Unchallenged.
Sure.
Pretty much unchallenged. I'm surprised by that.
I have a framed photo of The Rock on my desk. I mean, what do I have to do?
Okay. All right. Okay. Right. So I need to come up with an Easter egg thing. Okay. Please welcome our The Rock correspondent, a man.
Actually, I've changed my mind. I'm unhappy about this.
Oh, for goodness sake.
He's not allowed to
listen,
be The Rock correspondent.
You are the star of the fourth highest grossing film of all time.
Only the fourth.
Only the fourth? Oh, my God. What a monster.
I'm calling my agent.
You genuine monster.
I want off this podcast. Say it's the second.
Something terrible has happened to this podcast. It's just clash of the egos.
Oh, it's the candy asses everywhere. Let's just continue.
The ego has landed. All right, so please welcome our official The Rock correspondent.
Thank you.
A man who has a picture of what I thought were two Easter eggs on his screensaver. Then I realised it was just a close-up of The Rock's testicles. Will you please welcome John Nugent? I have a short notice.
Yeah.
That's not bad, actually.
That's okay.
It's not bad. Excuse me. You sit in the hot seat for 1 week.
Yeah, it didn't
go
well.
And you think you can come in here and criticise me?
Well. I was praising you.
You think you can come in here?
I was praising you.
And bust my balls?
Okay, fine.
And okay.
You're
that's
terrible.
Fine. Terrible.
Yeah. Terrible.
All right. Should we deal with this week's question?
Yeah.
Yes.
It's via Twitter, and it is from @_ringmav, and he asks, Sergio M is his name. What is your favourite scene with lasers? They could be deadly, they could be risky, or they could be sexy.
Sexy.
Sexy lasers.
Risky lasers.
All lasers are intrinsically risky, aren't they?
Yeah. They can have your eye out.
Sophisticated heat beam that we call a laser.
Have you written this down?
Yeah, I wrote that down. That's from Austin Powers.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Laser.
Blade, laser, blazer. That's the greatest laser scene.
Yeah, that is a good scene.
From Dodgeball. Amazing.
So I'm just going to throw in one of the obvious ones straight away, Resident Evil, in which Colin Salmon gets... turned into a smoked salmon by he goes into
he spawned
some kind
his
of,
last
he goes into a laser chamber. I think that's the technical
he
term.
Doesn't know it's a laser chamber when he goes into it. In fairness,
he thinks it's
him.
Just he's been told it's just a chamber.
It's just a chamber. And salmon, he loves a chamber. That's Colin Salmon. You just, you know, it's the best way. If you want to kidnap Colin Salmon, just go, psst, I got a chamber.
Is that why he was going to be in Bond for
it's,
that?
Yeah,
it's a chamber of secrets. The secret is that it's got lasers, and he gets he gets kind of sliced, and his bits of his face kind of slide off. It's quite grisly.
It's a bit ripped off Cube, that sequence, but...
Homage.
Homaged.
It homage.
References the mise-en-scène.
So the thing about that, because I watched the scene recently, okay, and it's interesting because the game does not play fair with Colin Salmon. So four people go in, I don't know if you remember the scene in Resident Evil, it's the best scene in the movie. Four people go into the chamber, and they think it's just a chamber. Then the Red Queen, who controls the hive under Raccoon City, she goes, no. And so she activates a laser, which comes along and cuts one of the people in
cuts off a guy's fingers.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're like, oh my God, oh my God. And then another laser comes along at knee height.
Yeah.
And so they start jumping. Oh yeah, someone gets decapitated. And then there's three of them left. And so the laser comes along at knee height. And so a guy jumps to try and avoid it. But the laser then goes up
with him
and cuts him in half. So then Colin Salmon, it comes for Colin Salmon as well. But being Colin Salmon, he's able to outwit it because he's amazing. And he grabs onto the ceiling and he leaps up and the laser goes underneath him just about and cuts off a piece of his knife. And then it comes back again. And this time it does what it should have done the first time, which is it goes into that grid thing and there's no escape. Yeah. And then, you know, it gets shot off like a nanosecond after it slices him and dices him.
Yeah.
I've just been playing the video game Horizon Zero Dawn, and there's a scene which I think is inspired by this. There's a level where you have to dodge lasers in inventive ways.
Wow.
So there we go.
Inspired by this scene that's homaging another scene.
Did you get sliced and diced?
Many times.
Roger Ebert made that point, actually, that are we saying that this corridor of laser doom has got a sense of humour? Because obviously, if it had just unleashed the lattice effect early doors, it wouldn't have had to faff around with the extra power that it needed to charge the other lasers, you know? It just sliced everyone in one go. But instead, it's kind of, I don't know, it's a bit malicious.
It'd be a much shorter film then, wouldn't it?
True. Yeah. You think they're just stalling for time?
Doesn't it also comes back? The laser corridor comes back in one of the other Resident Evils, 2, 3, 4, 5, or 6. Okay. One of those, yeah. Mm-hmm. And near the slices and dices, Mila Jovovich. Yeah.
It's a classic like heist movie sort of trope, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I mean, I really like the scene in Wallace and Gromit: Wrong Trousers, where they try and steal the crystal from a laser art gallery or something. It's laser security.
Yeah,
you know,
that's a good one. What about Laura Linney in Congo?
Beg your pardon. Please explain.
Laura Linney in Congo is confronted with an army of militarized apes inside a volcano.
Okay.
It all makes sense in context.
Yeah. All right.
And she sort of improvises a laser gun using a diamond that she just happens to find.
That's pretty cool.
Mm.
I don't remember.
You know, and then she just unleashes.
I remember Tim Curry's accent.
Yeah.
Yes.
City of Zing.
I think I remember that. And just Amy. Just kill Amy. She's annoying.
I remember Bruce Campbell being killed at the beginning and being really disappointed by that.
Yeah. It's a good opening. Just going back to what John was saying, heist scenes, there's obviously Entrapment. It's probably the most famous one.
I believe that's what Sergio was referring to when he said lasers can be sexy.
Yeah, those are possibly, sexy lasers.
Those are the sexiest lasers in cinema. And
just to explain.
Yeah.
It's a room full of, it's a trial run, is it, for something, with Sean Connery? He's sort of
leisures.
He's been there before. He knows what they can do.
Do you think someone who just hated Sean Connery just put that script in front of him, knowing he'd have to say the word
leisures?
Almost every one of my lines.
You must surreptitiously slide through this network of leisures.
Who wrote this? Call it your leisure chamber. But yeah, that scene is kind of spoofed a bit in Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back, I want to say. That one, right?
You must watch yourself lest you get sliced and diced like Colin Salmon. I'm just going to call it a sophisticated heat beam from now on, you fuckers. And Catherine Zeta-Jones has to... She has to contort herself into all forms of...
In a cat suit as well.
Cat suity business.
Leather cat suit.
And every time it cuts back to Sean, who's watching her, he looks like a man who's just been confronted with his tax returns. It's an incredible kind of disconnect.
He probably had.
He doesn't look. He is not finding it sexy.
I'm not happy about this.
Yeah.
But I believe that was. I believe the lasers were on the poster, which might be a first for that film. I believe. Ooh. Maybe.
Yeah.
I'm going to put a shout in for Real Genius, which is a great 80s comedy with Val Kilmer. It's about young kind of scientist type people who are a bit anarchic. And Val Kilmer's character uses a laser to pop popcorn in someone's house. He fills an entire house with popcorn using a laser. That's just science. You can do that.
Amazing.
That's cool.
Has no one mentioned lightsabers?
No.
Are they lasers?
Is that a laser
sword?
Is that really
laser
swords?
Laser swords.
They're laser swords.
What about the Ghostbusters?
Proton pack. It's a proton
laser. Is that
laser?
A laser?
I don't know. Scientists
technically
will tell us.
A proton beam.
The best laser seen in history has to be Goldfinger trying to cut Bond right up the middle, hasn't it?
Laser crutch,
doesn't it?
Yes. Laser.
No, another laser. Why do I keep appearing in laser movies?
It split me right up the scrotum. That is that is a good one. Lasers appear in Bond all the time.
Yeah.
They're sort of shorthand for evil genius who's invented something amazing.
There's like a,
which gets less impressive as everyone else has lasers.
There's a full-on laser fight in space in Moonraker.
It's amazing.
Yes. Well,
it's
they're literally shooting guns with lasers, and it somehow seems like Star Wars, only it's set in the present day in the 70s. It's quite strange.
That's very much they were trying to cash in on Star Wars fever, I think, with that one.
Yeah.
But
that fight, though, I mean,
unlike Star Wars, it doesn't end. It just keeps going. It's just Roger Moore. Yeah. That was the film in the Bondathon that broke me. I remember just having to leave and walk around the plaza on Oxford Street and then coming back about an hour later. And
it's breaking
happening.
The rules of the Bondathon. Can we reveal this 10 years down the line, 11 years down the line?
Cut this out.
No, staying in. Nick's and Bond's shame. Club.
I was metaphorically walking around the plaza.
Moonraker will hit you at your weakest point, and it is, I think, one of the very worst of the Bond movies. But John makes a good point about that battle. Knowing how long it takes to get suited up to go into space, I can't imagine that battle unfolded in anything under like 4 or 5 months, whilst all the troops had to have their helmets fixed. Go, guys, go! And it's 4 hours later, he's fitting his breathing apparatus.
It does surprise me that Bond hasn't really, dallied or tarried with lasers, has he, really, over the years since then?
Brosnan's laser watch.
Yeah. There's also Die Another Day. There's a few lasers used for cutting diamonds in the Ice Palace, as I'm sure we all remember.
It's on the tip of my tongue constantly.
Tron
uses lasers.
Does it? I think.
Yeah. So. But is there a scene that's better than James Bond and the case of the toasted testicles?
Yes. 2002 Brit social realist drama Ali G Into House features probably my favourite laser scene and the only funny bit in the entire movie, in which they're breaking into a country house and it's got the entrapment style laser lattice security network.
Yeah.
And Ali G gets his mate, he goes into the laser room and he gets his mate to have it smoke on a bong and then use the smoke to shot where the lasers are, and then they proceed to like electro body pop across the room to Afrika Bambaataa.
I don't remember this.
Have you not seen it?
I don't remember this.
Actually very funny. At least I thought it was funny.
Wow.
Dave, will you use your special skills to help us through the room? The laser room.
Yeah.
It's so a bad film.
All three of them go through like together doing like through the through the beams.
You should see the shapes that Phil is throwing right now.
It's pretty fresh.
It's something to behold.
It was dope.
Mission Impossible. Possibly the greatest set piece in the Mission Impossible series, if you don't count Sean Harrison inside a glass box.
Whispering Sean Harrison. Still in the box.
Oh, God, what have I unleashed? But yeah, obviously, he's heading into Langley, Ethan Hunt, and he's trying to get into that very high protected room and dodges lasers and all manner of other things.
Amazing.
And then Austin Powers. We've got to mention the sharks with frickin' laser beams attached to their head. Now, I can't remember if. Do you actually see the sharks?
In Goldmember, you do.
Do you see them in Goldmember? Yeah. Do they live up to that?
No.
That description?
Not really.
Are they great whites or are they just small sharks?
I can't remember.
I thought they were sea bass.
Yeah, but no, by Goldmember, I think he has the sharks with freaking laser beams attached to their foreheads. Yeah.
Gotcha.
Freaking laser beams. Yeah. Gotcha.
There's not that many sci-fi has been mentioned.
Okay.
I'm not going to mention any, I'm just saying.
Okay.
Apart from maybe The Day the Earth Stood Still, because Gort has like laser eyes.
Doesn't he?
War of the Worlds as well. The tripods kind of use lasers to explode people.
Star Trek, they use lasers, don't they? To, kill people.
Mm-hmm.
To stun them.
X-Men, Cyclops, his eyes are basically lasers, right? Right?
Yeah.
Mutant lasers.
The Death Star.
The Death Star.
The Death Star. What do we call the space
weapon? The energy beam.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's still Goldfinger. It's got to be Goldfinger, hasn't it? It's a bit, it's the first time I ever really realised what a laser could do to a man.
Yeah.
Almost do damage to their genitals.
Almost, yeah.
And then
And then years later, some grilled salmon. I'm hungry now. Should we move on? I think we nailed it.
That's the correct answer, yes.
That was amazing. So if you have any questions that you'd like to be read out in the Empire podcast, you can get in touch with us via all sorts of different ways. We're on Twitter as at Empire Magazine. Use the hashtag Empire Podcast, or chances are we won't see it. We're on Facebook as Empire Magazine, of course, and we're on email as well as podcast at empireonline.com. thefinestjamartins.com. Okay, time for this week's movie news. And yesterday, this is recorded on Thursday, so obviously something huge is going to break tonight ahead of Good Friday and ahead of the Easter weekend. But yesterday brought two fairly big, juicy pieces of casting news. First of all, there was Jude Law being cast as Young Dumbledore, as the internet has already dubbed him, Yumbledore, and Josh Brolin as Cable, which is a tidy piece of casting. Cable tidy. Piece of casting in Deadpool 2.
It's exciting.
Cable news.
Cable, very good. That's better than mine.
There were rumours that David Harbour or Michael Shannon were going to play Cable.
I think Stephen, at one point Stephen everybody... Lang as well, I think, from Avatar. I think he was kind of campaigning for it.
Actually campaigning for it.
Well, he was tweeting about it, as I recall.
Yeah, I think he was too old. I think that was the feeling, was that Cable's sort of more in his 40s, early 50s, and he's kind of in his 60s now, isn't he?
Do not doubt. Slang. You can do anything.
Yeah.
Slang can pay 20 years younger.
I agree. And Ron Perlman was also throwing his what do you call it? Hat. That's the thing you put in your head. 2 hours sleep. His hat into the ring earlier on. Yeah. But I think this is a good casting. I mean, Michael Shannon seemed to be the front runner recently, but Josh Brolin has emerged from the pack.
Of course,
to take on the role of Cable. Should we explain who Cable is first of all for people who don't necessarily
it's a
tough
know? Thing I've been reading up on.
Have you? Yeah,
it's pretty complicated.
It's complicated, but the essence is that he is the okay. He is a warrior soldier from the future. His name is Nathan Summers, and he is the son of Scott Summers, aka Cyclops, Madeline Pryor, who is a clone of Jean Grey in the X-Men comics. It's all very, very complicated. And then when he's born in present day, he is whisked because he gets this techno fire as it starts to coat his body and poses a real threat to him, and he gets sent to the future so he'll be fine. And there he grows up to become Cable, and then something happens, I can't remember what, it brings him back to the present day, and he's this grizzled, hardened veteran with laser eye and robot stuff all over the place, and he's a powerful, tough warrior, and he takes over X-Force, which is a sort of militant wing of the X-Men, and then there's and in the comics he has evolved to have a double act, if you will, with Deadpool, and they have a very they have several Deadpool and Cable series in which Deadpool breaks the fourth wall and Cable does not, and they have a very testy relationship, which should provide a lot of comedy, and that's as far as I can say about that at the moment. But he's an interesting character.
I mean, it's particularly interesting because Josh Brolin is already in a Marvel film, albeit a separate universe. He's Thanos in the MCU, so that's kind of intriguing. I mean, Deadpool 2 could come out almost around the same time as Avengers Infinity War. So we could see...
Yeah.
We could see Josh Brolin in two Marvel movies playing two separate characters.
Of course, he'll be recognisable as himself with Cable, with the white hair and whatnot. He'll be CG in Avengers.
He won't be on a space toilet.
He won't be on a space toilet. Well, he might be. You never know.
Got a hot fact.
Yeah.
Do you want to hear it?
Yeah, I'd love to hear it.
He's the second actor to play Thanos and another role in the MCU. Damien Poitier played Thanos in The Avengers before he was recast.
Oh, the motion capture person.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he played one of Crossbones' henchmen in Captain America Civil War.
That is a hot fact.
That's a hot fact.
That is a hot fact. I've got another hot fact for you. Peter Dinklage is also someone who's starred in the MCU and the X-Men movies, because we know he's going to be in Infinity War. We don't know which role yet, but he's going to be in that. And, of course, he was Bolivar Trask in Days of Future Past. And Josh Brolin becomes... I mean, Jonah Hex is not, I think, officially part of the DCEU, but he is possibly the first person to play a role in the MCU, a DC comic book movie, and now a Fox X-Men movie as well. Ryan Reynolds would have to appear in the MCU for that to count. I'm sure there's other people as
Chris
well.
Chris Evans, of course. He was in Fantastic Four, which is technically the Foxyverse, and then he became Captain America.
Yeah. So, I saw some people going yesterday, is this going to be a problem? Is Josh Brolin going to be in both these movies a problem? No! But no, of course it's not going to be a problem. Idiots.
Ryan Reynolds actually tweeted. Did you see his tweet? He tweeted, "What the fuck, Fox? You can't play two characters in the same universe. Josh Brolin was in Sicario and I was in Sabrina the Teenage Witch." I mean, you kind of think, knowing Deadpool as we do, you kind of think they're going to address it.
Yeah.
Like, maybe Deadpool will have a winky look to camera and break the fourth wall.
There's got to be a Jonah Hex reference at some point. There's got to be something about space toilets. There's got to be, all sorts of stuff.
Yeah. No, Josh Brolin seems like a good pair up. Him versus Ryan Reynolds. I think Josh Brolin has got the kind of the sense of humour. He's a very funny guy. I think he'll fit into this world for a while. Mm. Tear some shit up.
Yeah, there were rumours that there's a multiple film contract.
Mm. Where does this leave the big metal bloke?
Colossus.
Yeah,
I don't know.
And
Rustin in the workshop.
Negasonic Warhead.
Yeah, I don't know if they're going to be in it or not. We shall see. But it's exciting. So Deadpool 2 seems to be coming together fairly quickly. They're casting more and more. But that was the key one, I think. That was the key one. And then the other bit of casting news, of course, was Jude Law as young Dumbledore in Fantastic Beasts 2.
I've got a pun.
Okay.
Can I deploy it?
You can.
Dumbledore.
I made that pun yesterday.
No!
I don't think we're the first to come up with that. I think if you Google,
I don't think anyone has come up with
it. If you look it on Twitter and search Dumbledore, I think you'll find quite a lot of results.
Oh, John. Tell me the Rock told you.
Breaker of dreams.
I wonder what colour Dumbledore's hair is going to be, because as we all know, of course, Dumbledore dies.
God, that was awful.
Thank you.
No, I'm pretty sure no one's made that joke.
No, I'm pretty sure nobody has.
You're the first.
I've been mulling it over for almost a full day now. So this is Jude Law. You know, this is, we knew that Dumbledore was going to be in this movie. It's been fairly heavily hinted at in the last one. It was confirmed a while ago. I thought it would have been interesting to see whether they would have gone for someone like a Jared Harris, but perhaps he's too old, and perhaps it's also maybe it might have been too strange him playing a younger version of his role originated by his dad. I think this is decent casting.
I googled young Michael Gambon just to see if there was any resemblance, and there wasn't.
He's more of a
really,
young Richard Harris.
But a young Richard Harris, there is a bit of resemblance. He's got that sort of square jaw and receding hairline a little bit.
I do wonder if he'll have the long hair, if he'll have the kind of the Dumbledore.
Well, I mean, he's more beard than man anyway, presumably. Yeah. So I don't think it particularly matters about.
He may not even have a beard.
Maybe.
You don't know.
Maybe.
So presumably we'll be getting scenes with Johnny Depp's Grindelwald, who I spoke to David Yates, the director, recently. He described what Johnny Depp is going to do in the next film as fruity. And he's kind of been captured, so presumably it's going to be some kind of magical Hannibal Lecter sort of scenario.
That'd be interesting, wouldn't it? Dumbledore as Clarice. But you do wonder at what point Jude Law's presence in this, does it turn it into a Dumbledore film rather than a Newt Scamander film, and is that a bad thing necessarily? I didn't particularly enjoy that character. I didn't particularly enjoy that film. But you know, is this a way of bringing in the heavy hitters? And
well, we know it's going to be largely set in Paris.
Uh-huh.
We don't know a huge amount beyond that. David Yates said this next one will be more sexy. I think was the
maybe Jude Law is bringing the sexy. Sexy
yeah,
Dumbledore.
That could be where it's coming from. So are we going to see kind of cutting between what Newt's up to in Paris and what Dumbledore is up to elsewhere? Who knows?
Who knows? We don't have the
answer.
Are
we going to be calling it Sexy Beasts?
And where to grind them.
I mean,
oh God.
What?
You had to go just that bit too far and then a lot further and then a bit more.
Listen, just because you've sat in the hot seat once, you can't just keep critiquing.
I can and I will.
No, just do what you normally do, Phil.
Power struggle.
Do what you normally do. Just log on to iTunes under an array of assumed names and leave 1-star reviews. That's what you do.
How did you know that?
You don't criticise me during the podcast.
What do we think about Dolph Lundgren joining Aquaman?
I'm very excited on a 4-year deal. Dolph Lundgren has joined Aquaman, but we don't know anything else about that.
Very little.
Could be playing a dolphin. That's my first assumption. Dolph Lundgren should be in more big movies.
He should be.
He might be playing his sort of submarine captain guy from Hail Caesar.
The Submariner.
Did you see his tweet after Trump got elected where he said, my real name is Dolphin Lundgren. Come join me, America, in my underwater paradise.
Another terrible joke I've been beaten to.
Yes, Dolph himself beat you to it.
Do you think that there was a mistake in the casting call initially? We're looking for a dolphin to star in Aquaman.
He's going to be motion capping a dolphin.
Ocean capture.
Come on, get serious, people. He's playing King Nereus of the aquatic kingdom of Zebel. What did I say that was funny? Do you think he plays
beautifully negotiated?
He's going to be cast as Captain Birdseye.
How do you pronounce that? Captain Birdseye, that'd be amazing. Who's he playing?
I just told you.
Yeah, but you told this in a way that was King Nereus Sebul. I'm saying Sebul. Simple for that. He claims Mira as his own and he wants to kill Aquaman. Well, good luck, Aquaman. I know Jason Momoa is built like the archetypal aquatic brick shithouse, but Dolph Lundgren, he's a guy who killed Carl Weathers. Character in the Rocky movies. Carl Weathers is alive and was sitting in this very chair a few weeks ago. But, you know, I don't know. Sure. Dolph Lundgren's got something about him.
He's not playing He-Man. He's playing Seaman.
Oh!
That's going to be my last
bad original
joke. That's an original. That's so, Transformers 5, Transformers The Last Night, the trailer has just dropped. What do we think of that?
Well,
I mean, there are robots. There are explosions.
Yeah. It's a tough one to get to sunsets. Grips with. It's a tough one to get to grips with slightly, and I've seen about 15 to 20 minutes of footage, and I'm still a little bit confused about King Arthur and what his role is. Not to mention the Nazis.
Yes.
They're holding the Nazi stuff back. I think the movie starts with a flashback to King Arthur, who is getting quite drunk. That was the footage we were shown.
Yeah.
Merlin is kind of... And then they show some shots of the Round Table, but there are Transformers with big swords instead of knights, so it implies that the knights were robots,
right?
And Anthony Hopkins, this character in the film, seems to be the keeper of the law. So we saw a film where Mark Wahlberg, returning as Cade Yeager, gets taken to see Anthony Hopkins in his kind of English stately home, and Anthony Hopkins has got a robot butler called Cogman. I almost said Cogsworth. But Anthony Hopkins is got a big library full of books, so he's very clever. And he's explaining the plot. And I don't know where the Nazis come in, but we'll find that out.
Mm. Yeah, it's you know, it was a trailer. And it had lots of things exploding in it. And they seem to be, within the trailer, setting up Optimus Prime as the kind of bad guy of the piece. And then in the same trailer, going, no, he's the hero as well. And he's doing whatever it is that he does.
He's done a Dominic Toretto, isn't
yeah,
he?
Yeah, he seems to be under some sort of mind control or something, yeah. Doesn't he?
I like to think of this film as Michael Bay's Tree of Life. It's a sort of a discursive overview of the history of the planet. With robots.
And that's the key.
Yeah.
With robots. I don't know. It looked exactly the same as all the other
they
movies.
They made loads of money, so he's not going to mess with the formula.
I noticed there's an exciting new font on the logo. That was a big change.
Really? Mm.
Yeah.
I don't know. We shall see. I really like the first movie. Less so the subsequent ones, but fingers crossed this might be a return to form.
I'm intrigued by all the historical stuff.
We should mention this as well. People might be asking... wondering why we're not talking about the Star Wars The Last Jedi trailer, which will be out. This has obviously been recorded before Star Wars Celebration really launches and before that opens and before we get the trailer, but you can assume that we've all lost our collective minds and we're going apeshit over it over the Easter weekend, and maybe we'll talk about it in next week's podcast. It's going to be very, very interesting. So but in the absence of that, we should talk about the one that, you know, is out there and got us really excited and from the looks of things on the internet got everybody excited.
Yeah.
And that, of course, is Thor Ragnarok.
It's joyous, isn't it? Come on. It looks superb. This is Taika Waititi in the director's chair, bringing some of the sort of warm tone and humour that we loved so much in Hunt for the Wilder People and What We Do in the Shadows. And I don't know, I have a feeling this could be the best Thor film yet.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the MCU, I don't think that's hugely difficult. I mean, I like both Thor movies. Nick does not like Thor The Dark World in particular. And
stop
I know that's,
getting Greenwich wrong.
Stop getting Greenwich wrong, yeah, absolutely. Stop getting the tube system wrong.
Yeah, I didn't love the last one at all. I quite like the first one, but this is really exciting. This is the Marvel film I'm kind of most excited about this year. It just looks really fun. And there's a lovely little Skux Life Hunt for the World of People Easter egg. You can see that as graffiti behind Four in one shot.
Mm-hmm. It's got goth Cate Blanchett looking amazing.
It's got Goldblum.
It's got camp Jeff Goldblum looking even more amazing. It's got bald Carl Urban.
Yeah,
machine guns. It's got the Hulk.
Yeah.
It's got Loki just sort of Loki doing just something with knives.
Hanging out, yeah.
Sort of flipping knives.
The thing I've been saying about this movie for a long time is I don't know. It just seems to be so much stuff to get into this film. And I don't think this is even beginning to hint at the craziness in this movie. We have no idea about what Loki's plan is, what's going on, how Cate Blanchett's character fits into things. But it's interesting, you know, we see Mjolnir, the enchanted hammer being destroyed at the beginning of it. It has a nice bit of levity. It's Ragnarok, it's, you know, the Norse apocalypse. It's meant to be, you know, death and destruction and grimness, but it seems to have a real colour, a real sci-fi feel, more like a Star Wars movie than anything else. Yeah, I'm perhaps predisposed to like it, but I thought it was very, very good. And of course, we get the glimpse of Thor and Hulk at the end, which results in the funniest line in the trailer: "I know him; he's a friend from work." So that's
good stuff.
It is good stuff.
Good font as well.
A really good title.
Great font.
Yeah. So yeah. Fingers crossed that the next trailer doesn't doesn't let the air out of the balloon. But I've got
Comic Sans. God no.
I've got a good feeling about this one, so yeah, that's fantastic.
Do you know when I was recently sitting in here getting excited about Triple Frontier, previously Catherine Bigelow,
yeah,
Mark Boll, J.C. Chandler was aboard, yeah. They had cast members, they found the frontiers they needed, it was all go at Paramount. I think I've jinxed it, because it's all collapsed again,
yeah,
like a week later.
It has.
We had Tom Hardy had signed up, and Channing Tatum was obviously already aboard, and both of them have dropped out of the movie, and Paramount has dropped out of the movie, and it's now back in what you would describe as movie limbo.
Yeah,
I would say
development hell, which is a real shame, because this is about the drug war, isn't it?
This is the border between Paraguay, Argentina, and Brazil.
Okay,
and it charts. I guess there's a bit of a zero dot that I guess it's a bit of a Sicario thing. Yeah. Kind of getting down there and trying to sort out organised crime. So it sounds like a thrilling, exciting movie, and the location could maybe is particularly cool.
Yeah, maybe be a little nebulous, perhaps. Maybe, which is one of the reasons why some really talented directors have had problems zeroing in on that and getting it to the starting line. I feel sorry for J.C. Chandor, who is a fantastic director. I think all three of his movies are belters. And, you know, he had difficulties on Deepwater Horizon, and he left that project when it was deep into prep, and went on to this, and now the same thing's happened again.
He's having a tough time at the moment. He makes the sort of movies that are hard to get made, I guess.
I guess
thinky type of Deepwater Horizon than the Peter Berg version, which was more
but also
muscular.
You know, the fact is, even the more muscular version of that movie didn't do that well at the box office. So it's kind of interesting. You know, we keep referring to what Chris McQuarrie said in the live podcast about how he feels that Hollywood is beginning to move back in the direction of adult movies and adult thrillers and adult themes. But if they're not putting the bums on the seats, then it's going to be hard to get them funded. Unless, of course, at the last minute, you know, if this remains with Paramount.
Yeah.
If this remains with them, then it remains with them. But if this is open to bidding, then this sounds like the sort of project that a Netflix or an Amazon would kill themselves to be involved with. But, you know, hey-ho, we wish them all the best. Oh, we should also mention as well that, talking about Catherine Bigelow, that the trailer for her new film Detroit was out this week, and looks very, very good about the Detroit riots of 1967. It was a police raid that went horribly wrong. Great cast, Will Poulter, John Boyega. Looks very, very good. Looks very intense. So that's out in August. And yes, we should mention Cannes. We should finish off with Cannes, because the Cannes lineup was announced today as we were about to come into the podcast booth. What are the highlights? What can we expect?
Well, there's lots of big directors in the competition. We've got new films from Todd Haynes, from Sofia Coppola, from Noah Baumbach. Michael Haneke, who's a bit of a Cannes mainstay, is here with his new film Happy End, which probably won't have one. There's new film from Bong Joon-ho, who directed Snowpiercer. There's latest film from Lynn Ramsey after We Need to Talk About Kevin. That's her first film in a few years. There's David Lynch is premiering the new Twin Peaks. Jane Campion is...
How much are they showing of that?
I think I saw just the first two episodes.
Two episodes.
But that's quite exciting, obviously. And Top of the Lake from Jane Campion is also premiering, so a bit of TV.
Which is something that the film festival has avoided in the past.
So that's sort of a sign of the times, I suppose.
Yeah. Obviously, they're still doing it in a very, very Cannes way. They're showing Twin Peaks because it's David Lynch.
Yes.
They're showing Top of the Lake because it's Jane Campion. They wouldn't show, for example, Peter Kay's Car Share, which is, I have to say, fantastic. If you're not watching it, go and watch it.
Next year for Celebrity MasterChef.
My God. Peter Kay's Celebrity MasterChef. Now we're talking.
It's really interesting, just going back to Twin Peaks, it's really interesting he's taking that to Cannes, because famously his movie that he did after the TV show, back in the 90s, Firewalk With Me. He took it to Cannes and everyone hated it and booed it, and it just got a terrible, terrible reception. So I'm presuming that's not going to happen again.
Well, you never know with Cannes. I mean, they do love a good boo, don't they? The Cannes audiences just like to boo for boo's sake.
The famous Vincent Cassel story about when Irreversible was screened at Cannes, and there was just somebody on the end of his row just booing and shouting abuse at the screen, and he turned around and it was like his brother. I'd like to think if I ever made a film and reached at a Cannes, bro, you would...
I'd throw a shoe.
Throw a shoe.
Throw a shoe. Just one.
Who throws a shoe?
Mark Kermode throws a shoe.
he apparently doesn't. He claims that he doesn't. He claims that story is apocryphal.
He tells it in his book, doesn't he?
Does he? Okay, yeah, well, that's where do people get this?
Oh, yes, there it is.
His book called Apocryphal Things?
Things that definitely didn't
listen,
happen.
Listen, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe the good doctor doesn't do that. But hello to Jason Isaacs.
A couple of things caught my eye. Yorgos Lanthimos' new film. Mm-hmm. The Lobster seems like a movie that has racist profile, and he's back with The Killing of a Sacred Deer, so I think that's going to be one. He's a big firm favourite with actors especially, so that's going to be one to keep an eye on. And Okja, you mentioned Bong Joon-ho's follow up to Snowpiercer, is a Netflix release.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure off the top of my head if that's the first time Netflix has had a movie in competition at
Feels
Cannes,
like it.
But I'm going to say it is.
Yeah.
Because I can't check. I can check, I'm just not going to. So we're just going to go with it.
Yeah.
And everyone's going to be okay.
In another sort of sign of the times, Alejandro González Iñárritu, the Revenant director, he's premiering a short film that's shot entirely in VR. It's the first VR film ever to debut at Cannes, which is maybe a sign of the future. Maybe all films in the future will be watched on headsets.
I hope it's a bear attack.
I knew it! I knew that was coming. I could see the expression in your face.
But no, genuinely, that'd be amazing. The Revenant VR experience.
Yeah. You'd be terrified, wouldn't you?
No, it'd be terrible. Or just wandering around in a wood. Yeah,
locked in a room with Tom Hardy's character. That'd be even more terrifying. But we've been corrected in real time. Nick just showed me a tweet preemptively correcting us. Mark Kermode didn't throw a shoe, apparently. He wishes he had.
Yeah, he corrected our podcast last time we said that. So,
corrected by
fact checking live.
A
sorry,
rival
Mark.
Podcast.
Yeah, so next year we'll make the same allegation about him as well. Why does Mark Kermode always throw his shoes? You always see him down the street just limping around because he's just thrown a shoe at a film. that's why they had to close Blockbuster.
I sat near him during Smurfs The Lost Village a couple of weeks ago. He didn't throw a shoe during that, and I think that's the film that you would throw a shoe at.
Yes, it's shoe throwable.
Yeah,
he was lobbing Birkenstocks. All right, shall we move on? That's enough for the movie news. Cannes seems very, very exciting. Time now for a guest, making a welcome return to our screens and indeed to our pod booth this week, as she burst onto the scene a few years ago with eye-catching turns in blockbusters like Quantum of Solace, Clash of the Titans, and Prince of Persia. Since then, she's focused on diverse work in British indies like Byzantium, The Girl with All the Gifts, and stage work as well. And now Gemma Arterton, for It Is She, is back as the star of wartime drama Their Finest. And John here caught up with her this week.
Yes,
this week. What did you talk about? Give the listeners a little idea.
We talked about the film Their Finest and some other some other things.
Do you remember what you talked about?
It's so long ago. It was 48 hours ago. We talked about Inside Number 9, which she guest starred on.
She did. Tom and Jerry.
And Quantum of Solace.
Good.
And she's starring in a new version of Watership Down.
Is she?
Yes.
Oh, this sounds good.
She's voicing a rabbit in Watership Down, so that's exciting.
Wow.
So John Baker's doing a voice in that as well.
Yeah, it's a big all-star cast. But I mean, you're literally about to hear it, so I'm just spoiling.
I'm not.
I'm spoiling the interview.
You're not. Yeah, I'm
no.
not. Yeah, but
the listeners are.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah.
Well, listen, you've been teed up. You've been teed up. Here we go. Gemma Arterton talking about all those things. Enjoy.
We are delighted to welcome to the Empire Podcast Gemma Arterton. How are you?
Hello, I'm very well, thank you.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
We are here to talk about Their Finest. How would you describe this movie? Would you call it a wartime feminist romantic comedy behind the scenes drama?
I don't think you can define it.
No.
It's not to be pigeonholed. It's weird. I think, you know, Lona Scherfig is the master of sort of trans-genre movies, And this one is one of them. I mean, there are moments where all of these things are happening at the same time, especially the comedy and the tragedy, which is what makes it really special, I think.
It's an amazing time for cinema as well. I mean, this is a time, I think they say in the film, like 30 million people a week are going to see films.
Which is extraordinary. If you think about nowadays, I guess it's just a different world we live in. But back then, cinema was really the only form of, apart from radio, obviously, communication. And it was like a real... It really brought people together. Propaganda movies were being churned out at a hugely rapid rate, and actually they were being financed by the government, and they were something that the people needed. It was a time when cinema was sort of essential in a way that is not the same as today. People wanted to see films because it gave them hope, and it gave them a reason to continue, and it also gave them something to relate to. One of the early films, the opening shot actually is of a film that we found in the BFI archive, which is a film that was mocked by the general public at the time because it was so ridiculous. It was all these women in munitions factories saying, "Come on, girls, a million bullets by morning. Let's do it for our boys." And all the women in the cinema just threw their and they shouted and they booed at it and they hated it because it wasn't real. And so there was this movement during the war of actually cinema having to change and become something that really spoke to the people and that was very truthful. And even with the kind of relatively small amount of propaganda movies of that time that I've seen, you really see a difference in the way that the performances are portrayed, the style of acting, which becomes much more naturalistic. Even just the things that they're talking about in these scenes are about everyday life. Really, it's sort of where the kitchen sink drama originated, because that's what people needed at that time.
This is a film within a film. I'm always interested in films like this. Is it strange to have sort of two sets of film crews on set? Like you've got a gaffer and a pretend gaffer.
Yeah, it was really funny actually, because we had, you know, there was everyone. There was the first AD, and then we had, you know, focus puller and cameraman, we had the DP, the cinematographer. And it was really funny because we had the real guy who was Sebastian, the DP, who was sort of saying, "Well, no, you wouldn't do that." Right. You know, you would walk around and you'd have your little eye thing and, you know, whatever. But yeah, it was quite funny. My favourite scenes to shoot were definitely the ones of us on set. I just remember this day. It's when Jake Lacey's character does that scene where he goes, "Don't be a fool, Johnny, there's a sniper out there." And we were all on set, all of the crew, all of the actors, all of the crew within the crew, and, you know, and it was, and you see them say, "Take one, da da da," and measuring up, and and we all knew what we were doing because that's what we do. Yeah. You know, it was the first time, I guess, for all of us that we really were confident that we were actually historically right and right. Doing the right things. It's quite interesting being the writer on set because Sam and I, you know, we realized how awful actors are to writers. You know, they come on set, they change the lines, they don't say what was written, and yeah, I definitely that was interesting for me.
Was there a few parallels to real life from your experience then? I mean, have there been like notes from up high? I mean, maybe not from the government, but
yeah,
but from studios, that
thing. Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, I mean, there's always somebody interfering and coming in and whispering into somebody's ear and all of that, and you see the poor writers kind of, you know, having a crisis.
Yeah.
I've got quite a lot of friends that are film writers, and they find it really difficult being on film set.
Yeah.
Some of them find it really, really interesting, but I think it can, you know, a couple of days is enough because it must be quite hard for them because it comes out of their mind and then, you know, it's all being made. But I've always been such a so respectful of scripts. I think it's because I come from the theatre where the script is God, you know, you do not mess with the script, and you don't even change a comma or a full stop, you know, it is what it is. But in film, it's always changing, you know, scripts will change on the day and lines will change, and, you know, it's definitely a different kind of attitude. But I'm always very, I like to think I'm quite respectful of the script, so.
Fair enough. You spend a lot of time opposite Bill Nighy in this movie, who you obviously work with on The Boat That Rocked. What's it like sparring with someone like that? I mean, as an actor, what sort of acting partner is Bill?
Oh, he's just joy. I mean, he gives you like gems, little nuggets, and you just have to react. And I remember my first scene with Bill really was the one where he signs the script, and I say, oh, I wrote the script. I didn't want an autograph, you know, that one. And he was so pompous in the scene. It was just so easy to feel sort of flustered. And, you know, but in real life, he really is exactly Bill Nighy. You know, he is a gentleman and he's very, very generous and doesn't have a big ego. And I think he's a genius with comedy. I mean, there is that really lovely scene at the end, which wasn't in the original script, and we added it in a reshoot of, and we have a scene together where I'm upset, and he kind of tells me about how to continue, and he has this amazing moment of being incredibly touching, and then within on a sixpence, he's so funny, and that really is sort of his genius, is to be able to play comedy and drama at the same time. It's really, really rare. So such a joy to watch and work with.
It does seem like the sort of role that only he could play. It seems like a very Bill Nighy sort
of
role.
It's really funny though, because at the read through he couldn't be there, so Richard E. Grant, who's also in the film, read his part, and he was really good. I think Richard E. Grant he could have done that part, to be honest, but he's really, really brilliant in his role as well. And I remember on set, Richard's a friend of mine anyway, and he really is one of the funniest people I've ever met. He doesn't have to do anything, and he's funny. He just has this sort of dour face, and he makes you laugh. But Bill really makes it really his own. And I think he has a real skill for spotting roles which he can kind of do something special with, you know. And he really did. And also I think Lona saw how brilliant he was and gave him more opportunity to riff and play.
Yeah.
So
I was sort of looking back over your CV at what you've done. You've had some amazing sort of blockbuster and indie roles, but there was one that really stood out, was you guest starred in an episode of Inside Number 9.
Oh, yeah.
Which is, you know, it's one of the most inventive and original TV shows on at the moment.
Yeah.
I mean, what was that experience like for you?
I was so intimidated.
Really?
Because I'm big fans of the two of them.
Yeah.
And they're also just, they wrote it. And so I remember I wanted to do it because I just knew how brilliant it was. And you know when you read something and just think, I have to do it, you know. And we turned up on set, and it was the first sort of thing I'd done, which was like a offbeat comedy, dark comedy actually. I remember being really, really nervous. But they really, I mean, I loved that first series of Inside Number 9. I mean, especially the one where it's all a silent film, because
it's
just genius. I think they're really talented, the two of them.
Each episode is sort of like a one act play, isn't it?
It is, and it's incredibly, I mean, they're such excellent writers. And I think with anything that specific tonally, you really have to respect what they wrote. And I remember there was one word that I kept getting wrong, you know, my pronunciation was, and then I kept getting confused, thinking, what is it in the end, you know? And I remember having a little mini crisis, thinking, I'm letting them down, you know? But they it is like a mini play. They rehearse it. You have time to rehearse it with them. It's very specific.
Right.
It was interesting for me because it was the first time I'd done anything like that, to see how it is done, you know.
And it's been nearly a decade since you were in Quantum of Solace. which is, you know, quite a different sort of experience from their finest, I guess. Looking back, what's your memories of that? I read somewhere that your first day was getting covered in oil.
That wasn't the first day, I was only on that not for that long, actually.
Yeah.
I just had really, it feels like ages ago, but I had such a good time. I was so young and suddenly I was in, you know, Panama and meeting all these people and I just thought it was great. I just had a real trip. I didn't really know what was going on, to be honest. I was just sort of going along for the ride.
Yeah. But that role won you a Best Newcomer Award at the Empire Awards.
Yes, it did.
What's your memories of that night? Because, I mean, the Empire Awards has a bit of a reputation for being a bit of a wild...
A bit boozy. I think it was a bit boozy.
Yeah.
I think I remember having a whiskey before I went on stage to collect my prize. I don't even drink whiskey. It's like, why was I drinking whiskey?
I think they might have been a sponsor,
It was just like, here, have a whiskey. And all I remember is going up and saying something really not very funny. And about me not falling over somehow miraculously, which is not funny at all. I think back on at that time and I really didn't understand the significance of all of this stuff. I was just doing it, you know. Even the Empire Awards, I didn't realize how big they were. And I think it comes from, again, I didn't grow up watching films. I didn't grow up reading film magazines it was all new to me then. It really was. I'd left drama school 6 months before, where I'd just been doing theatre, and then the films that I was watching were, you know, weird indie foreign movies. It was all a new world to me.
And then I think I'm almost out of time, but next up you've got Watership Down, a new version of Watership Down for BBC.
Yeah.
Are you looking to traumatise a new generation of children?
Yes.
Is that the plan?
That's the plan. No, it's... it looks like it's going to be beautiful. The script is fantastic. We had the blessing of the writer and the cast are, you know, top notch. It's everyone from James McAvoy, Nick Hall, Anne-Marie Duff, Olivia Colman, Sir Ben Kingsley, just brilliant cast.
Yeah.
And I think it's going to be, I think for the new generation of kids, you know, when I was reading it, I thought, wow, this is such a relevant topic. And you can, it's, you know, I remember seeing it when I was a kid and just being kind of horrified.
Yeah.
But actually it's a really important story to tell. So yeah, it will be ready, I think, for Christmas, a jovial Christmas viewing.
Yeah. I remember watching the original and I refused to go to my garden for like 2 weeks because I was terrified of the rabbits.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, foaming, so, and they really foam and they have like bloodshot eyes, don't they?
Exactly. Well, we look forward to that. But Gemma Arterton, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you.
Thank you.
That was Gemma Arterton. She's great fun, isn't she?
She is lovely.
Yeah, she's awesome.
She's my finest. That sounded creepy.
All right, okay. It's time for this week's reviews. Their finest is out next week in the 21st. So we're going to start this week's reviews with a big blockbuster on the block, Fast and Furious 8. Not, sadly, in this country, The Fate of the Furious, but Fast and Furious 8 is its title. John, you take this one.
Yes, Fast and Furious 8.
Where do you begin?
Where do I begin? I mean, my goodness, the eighth film in a franchise is not usually... how many eighth films have there been where you think this is the best one? Like, this is... I mean, this is a bizarre franchise now. It started off as just a small film about illegal car racing, and it's just morphed into this mega franchise with stunts and explosions and about 100 characters and twists and turns. It's bonkers. It's absolutely bonkers. And the bonkers-a-thon doesn't really stop for the eighth edition. So as we join them, Dominic Toretto, Vin Diesel, and his lovely new wife, Letty, played by Michelle Rodriguez, they're on honeymoon in Cuba. They're doing what all couples on honeymoon do. They're
street races.
Illegal street racing with souped up with nitrous oxide. And then Toretto bumps into Cypher, a terrorist. I believe that's her birth name, Cypher, played by Charlize Theron. who blackmails him into betraying his family. His family!
You can't go against family.
Family.
Can't do it.
Do they say family a lot in this film?
Not at first, weirdly enough. Right,
okay. It's surprising how little family is said, but I mean,
It's there. Every sentence is...
I mean, I wasn't counting, but it didn't seem to me in the first 20 minutes or so that family was being said a lot. And then it gets said a lot.
It's more subtext, though. There's a lot of family subtext.
There's no subtext in the Fast and Furious movies.
So much family subtext here.
There's a sub, but there's no text.
There's very little text, yes. Right. So basically, Toretto turns. Toretto is basically the bad guy.
Oh.
Or is he? No, he's not. No, he's not the bad guy. But he's kind of blackmailed, and so this leads to various, you know, absurd stunts and set pieces. There's a huge set piece in New York where Cypher basically takes control of all of the cars using... computers or something. It's not really explained how she does. And then it all ends up in some secret military base in Russia or Greenland or something. Somewhere.
It's hard to tell.
A lot of the time, it's really hard to know what the hell is going on because it's insane, this movie. It's so insane. And with all of these movies, there's a really strange thing your brain does where you think, is this shit? Like, it really walks the tightrope of being terrible and fantastic. There's something genuinely entertaining and enjoyable about watching The Rock pick up a torpedo with his bare hands and throw it at a convoy of moving cars and the whole thing explodes.
I love the fact that the trailer had him, it was like a 3-minute trailer, and it had The Rock picking up two explosive objects that had been thrown at him and flinging them at someone else just twice. I can only imagine how many times he does it in the finished film.
It's unreal. And there's some great sort of manly banter between The Rock and the Staith, which, you know, really needs to be seen to be believed.
What we should say here is that the Staith is back in this movie as Deckard Shaw, who was the big bad of the last movie, Fast and Furious 7. he's back this time, and it's amazing. You can almost hear the writer, Chris Morgan, furiously scribbling on post-it notes, trying to retcon somehow a situation where Jason Statham's character, who killed, let's not forget, the best character in the franchise, Han Solo, played by Sung Kang, killed him at the end of Fast and Furious 6. Evil bugger in evil, you know, in Fast and Furious 7, trying to kill them all.
Fast and Furious 7, he destroys a hospital. he literally, like, murders loads of nurses and doctors just so he can visit his brother.
Yeah.
There is a strong sense with this franchise that they are just making this up, you know, just literally making up stuff. Because they retrofitted Statham into the film 3, right? And now they're retrofitting Charlize Theron into all the films.
Charlize Theron is basically like Christoph Waltz in Inspector. She's like, it was me
all along,
Toretto.
The architect of your car-based pain.
Yeah.
But yeah, I do love that there's an interesting fact about this series, that they come up with the stories sitting by Vin Diesel's swimming pool. And it's Vin Diesel and Chris Morgan sitting there drinking Coronas, presumably. And just coming up with utter rubbish. But it's kind of, these films for me are kind of the Roger Moore Bond films. They're kind of taken over from that, just kind of completely ludicrous.
Yeah, or ludicrous.
Literally ludicrous. But just fun in the way that the Bond films now are quite sort of serious and grim and gritty. Yeah. I love that there's a series of action films that's this silly.
Yes.
Yeah. That's the thing about it. You know, it's you're saying, are these films a bit shit? And yes, they are a bit shit, but they're also a bit awesome.
Joyous.
And the turning point for me with this franchise was with Fast 5, which is still one of the greatest experiences I've had in the cinema in the last few years. Just so much fun. I had my underwear on and I very much enjoyed it. And I think that the franchise has gone ever over the top and ever more ridiculous with each installment, and an attempt to maybe hit that sweet spot that they hit with Fast 5, which brought The Rock in and everything was suddenly about biceps and one-liners and ludicrous heists rather than the street races. And this sort of pumped up adrenalized version. Fast 6 was a lot of fun, but not as good as Fast 5. Fast 7 was again, probably not as good as Fast 6, but had that amazing bus chase come fight come car chase in Azerbaijan, which was really fantastic. And this one for me feels a little bit like the Law of Diminishing Returns is really kicking in now. There's a sense of flatness about the movie. The new director, F. Gary Gray, who's taken over from Justin Lin, who did the 3, 4, 5 and 6, and then James Wan, who did 7. And I wonder if Gary Gray, whose movies are generally quite serious, I wonder if he has a lightness of touch. There's a lot of exposition in this movie, and I felt that it was largely... It felt like NCIS. It felt like people were standing around screens, watching screens, and each had a line of dialogue. And they were a little bit interminable and just a little bit stagey.
There was a few too many scenes of people typing at computers, and with computers with screens the size of rooms, you know, that had sort of CGI holograms. And I did wonder that there was maybe lacking the sort of big signature stunt. You know, like the last movie had cars literally falling out of the sky and cars driving from one skyscraper to another.
Yeah. And that's not even the big stunt from that movie.
No, I mean, I felt like the big sort of set pieces weren't quite as epic as previous movies.
I kind of agree. I agree with that. But I still enjoyed it, and it still got a sense of ridiculousness. I think the Dom Toretto storyline is really quite morose and serious and a bit dark and weird, and it doesn't quite mesh with the rest of the movie. Although fans, people who are tracking the apparent real-life feud between The Rock and Vin Diesel will be intrigued to know that they very rarely share a screen in this movie, almost as if they were being kept apart. Who knows?
Almost as if one of them was a hashtag candy ass.
But I will say the MVP in this movie, The Rock, is great, but we know he's great. Kurt Russell is having the time of his life as Basil Exposition 2.0. But the MVP of this movie is the Staith. Because the movie has retconned furiously to try and make him a good guy, he gets a lot of stuff to do, and he does it with a sense of fun and a sense of swagger that
is
we don't get.
Some of that stuff involve rebuilding a hospital?
It doesn't. It's fantastic how they retcon him in.
This series has to go to space, right? I mean, it's, you would think. It's been talked about a lot, but it has to. It's got to have its own Moonraker.
It feels like this franchise and the Mission Impossible franchise are doing what the US and Russia, Soviet Union did in the sort of 50s and 60s. Some sort of space race going on. Because they have reached the limits of sort of Earth's stratosphere of how much nuts they can go.
But the Mission Impossible movies at least come from a position of, oh, here's Ethan Hunt, the world's greatest spy, and he's got all these incredible gadgets, and he can do this thing with, he's got this mask, and he can infiltrate anywhere, and he's got this wonderful skill set.
Box.
Yeah. Basically, the heroes of this movie are a bunch of mechanics who've just gone rogue.
Yeah.
And they've got this amazing skill set.
It's Quick Fit, the movie.
Well, there's a scene where this government agent turns up at the Rock's his daughter's soccer game, and he's like, you need to put together a team, and he's like, yeah, I know the team, and it's like, these aren't government agents, these are guys who just drive cars really fast. It's like a car-based mission,
and they've only recently started doing heists. But they're doing stuff that would take years of training. Dom Toretto is now this unbeatable, you know, just amazing hero who cannot lose at anything, and he's great at everything, and it's quite fun to watch that unfold. But the Staith is amazing. Staith's fantastic. MVP by a long, long way, and he's got the sort of sense of fun and the sense of swagger in this movie that you just wish he had in all those Wild Card or Mechanic Resurrection. And if he was having this much fun in those movies, he'd be a much, much, much bigger star.
We should also put a quick shout out to Helen Mirren, who plays his mum as a sort of East End matriarch, like a sort of Peggy Mitchell type. And she only has about 5 minutes on screen, but she's glorious.
Absolutely. So three stars. It's probably the most three-star film in the history of mankind, but it's got a lot of good stuff going for it. If you like this sort of thing, if you don't, you will hate every second.
How sweaty is The Rock?
I don't think there's a scene where he's not sweaty, to be honest. I think even in an air-conditioned room, there are beads on his forehead.
Yeah, you want to stand. You want to stand upwind.
It is amazing. I was on set of Fast and Furious 6. It was a nighttime scene being shot here in England, and it was freezing. But they were just, and it was a scene with dialogue in an underground car park, and they were like spraying sweat onto him. It's like, why is he this sweaty? He doesn't need.
Yeah, Mr. Johnson has his own personal sprayer.
It's amazing.
Travels with him at all times.
Yeah,
3 stars then for Fast and Furious 8. And next up is Park Chan-wook's latest movie, La Hand Maiden. Nicholas.
Hello. So yeah, this is the great Park Chan-wook. I think he's Tarantino's favourite director. He's an incredible guy who creates these very dark, twisted stories. A lot of the time there's revenge involved. So for this one, he's adapting a book by a Welsh writer called Sarah Waters, which is called Fingersmith, which is set in Victorian era Britain. And he's transplanted it to Korea. And it's a lot more twisted than the book is. It's the basic plot. It's quite labyrinthine, the plot. But the basic setup is that there is a young lady who is conspiring with this guy to... So she is going to become this rich lady's maid. And basically, between the two of them, they're going to drive her mad. And then when she's in an asylum, they're going to take her money. And there is it's done as a sort of three-act thing where it says Act 1, Act 2, Act 3. And, yeah, I don't want to kind of ruin where it goes, but it's very kind of entertaining.
It's also got this real sort of ornate, intricate sense of period as well. It's set in the 30s in Korea, and some of the characters are Japanese, and there's a kind of... Korea is occupied by the Japanese, so there's that sort of political subtext. It's a really interesting adaptation of taking the material from the book, which, as Nick says, is set in sort of Victorian England, and putting it somewhere else in a really effective way. And it's sort of one where you don't want to give too much away about kind of how it unfolds, because it's full of twists and turns. It's also, let's not be around the bush, quite sexy.
Mm-hmm.
This film is quite, I don't like to use this word too often, but it's quite erotic.
There's a bathtub scene involving a lollipop.
Is there?
just put that out there.
A bit of amateur dentistry.
Yep. Which is,
you know, contains no nudity, but is maybe the most sexual scene in the whole movie.
Yes.
You could argue.
It's an 18, so yes. It really does go to those places. And Sarah Waters has described it as sort of, the novelist has described it as sort of almost pornographic, but I mean, not in a critical way. Just that Park Chan-wook is not a guy that holds back, and
yes.
He doesn't hold back in any aspect of the story. It's full of gothic intrigue. It's full of sexual undercurrents. It's full of weirdness. It's got an octopus, which is something you'd expect from this filmmaker. And I just thought
even Fast
really
8 doesn't
terrific.
Have an octopus.
It's not a literal octopus in this one, unlike Old Boy.
Yeah.
It's more of a drawing of an octopus that's getting up to some pretty dirty business for an octopus.
Yes. The sex scenes are extremely explicit, but they do feel very integral to the plot. And what's interesting is that there's one which you sort of see more than once, and the second time you see it, it means something completely different. And this is the sort of film that I can't wait to see again, because you will go in knowing something quite different. The characters are all not what they quite appear to begin with.
It's a lot of scheming.
There's a lot of double-crossing.
There's a lot of double-crossing, triple-crossing.
Quadruple-crossing, I would say, almost.
The octopus may not be what he seems. I really enjoyed all the performances. I thought were really good. I enjoyed Ha Jong-woo as this count, who is just like the scummiest character of the year, surely. It's a horrible man with black leather gloves, and he's just super creepy. But yeah, the two female leads, both very, very good.
He has a club of equally seedy old blokes who come out and listen to her reading out pornography, doesn't he? And that's sort of kind of the weird... It's a film that keeps opening these weird chambers that you... Some of them you don't want to spend too much time in, but...
It's a very creepy book club.
Yeah, it's super... yeah. It's Richard and Judy's super creepy book club.
Yeah, it's been a pretty big hit. It's done better than any of Park Chan-wook's other films in America. In South Korea, it was huge and made more money than X-Men Apocalypse. So it's kind of been this unlikely crossover hit, but I definitely recommend it.
Well, there we go. 5 stars for The Handmaiden. So if you don't fancy watching The Rock and The Staith and lots of cars being smashed up, go and see The Handmaiden. But, you know,
both erotic in their own ways.
Yeah. So there you go. 5 stars. Or if you're an octopus, 8 stars. Last but not least, we move on to The Sense of an Ending. Phil.
Hi.
Hey.
Yeah. It's the third Booker Prize nominated adaptation of the week. And this one actually won the Booker Prize, Julian Barnes' novel, I think in about four or five years ago. And it's a story about a guy looking back on his life, effectively, and his younger years in particular. He's played by Jim Broadbent as an older man, Tony Webster. And he runs a photo shop and potters around. He's got a daughter who's having a baby and an ex-wife who he's still amicable with. And he's bequeathed some documents, basically, by an old friend. And these documents are in the possession of the old friend's daughter, who is someone that he used to go out with back in his school days. So the film carries across these two timelines. It goes back in time. Billy Howell plays the younger version of Tony, and you see him with a friend of his who he ends up losing to this girl. And it's a story that probably works better in the book because it's by definition about the unreliable narrator. And in this movie, you're never quite sure exactly what his memories are and what he's misremembering. And Jim Broadbent does a great job as this sort of really curmudgeonly, cranky guy. He's really unlikable, which we talk about often in the podcast. Does it matter if your main protagonist is really unlikable?
Yep.
But this is a guy who's kind of, he's semi-retired and he seems to have learnt nothing from any of his experiences in life. And he's bulldozing around in pursuit of this diary, digging up other people's skeletons as well as his own. And I think it's a great role for Jim Broadbent. He brings likability to even the most kind of unsympathetic characters, and he does it again here. It's directed by Ritesh Batra, and since I watched this, I went away and watched his previous film, The Lunchbox, which is an Indian sort of romantic comedy set around a sort of mistaken identity around a lunchbox, which I really enjoyed, and it was kind of a breakout hit for him. This does a good job of kind of getting a sense of London. Some dubious tube work in this. I think there's one bit where they go from the South Bank to the Bank to Highgate, which is just no one's idea.
Is Thor driving the tube?
Route. Ethan Hunt would pick him up on that. That's dreadful. We gave it 3 stars. You know, it's not by any means a bad adaptation. I just felt that it's probably one that works better written down, just by definition of the themes involved. And Jim Broadbent does good work. It reminded me very much of a film I really like, The Go-Between, the Joseph Lucy adaptation of L.P. Hartley's book, which also reminds me of Atonement, or vice versa, Joe Wright's adaptation of Ian McEwan's book. They're both kind of tackle the same themes, so I would watch those first and then this
as a primer for this one.
Definitely watch The Go-Between.
I'm
sure a lot of people listening have seen Atonement, but Go-Between, Atonement has the same sort of ideas. You know, a person in their older years looking back, half correctly and half imaginingly.
That's a word.
It's still a word.
That is
now.
A word. It's in
their younger,
it's in
you know,
novel.
The mistakes they made and the things that they did.
That's a Booker Prize winning word. And you know what? You can't beat a bit of Broadbent, which is difficult to say, but I managed it. And it's also, I believe, the film's tagline.
You can't beat a bit of Broadbent.
That should be, shouldn't it?
Can't beat a bit of Broadbent.
Should be every film's tagline. There we go. 3 stars, which, as you always say in the podcast, is, of course, a recommendation for the sense of an ending. And it's time to make sense of our own ending, because that is it for this week's Empire Podcast, brought to you by those mustard chaps at mustard.co.uk. Join us next week for more film-related fun. We'll be joined by Oscar-winning actor Geoffrey Rush.
No.
Yeah. Oh. And quite possibly, because it's not guaranteed, Warren Beatty.
Whoa.
Wow.
I know.
What happens if he doesn't come?
Then just Geoffrey Rush.
Oh, yeah. You don't want someone to pretend to be Warren Beatty.
That would be amazing. How good is your Warren Beatty impression?
Not good. The best foreign film goes to...
When it comes to Phil's Warren Beatty impression, rules do not apply.
There's been a mistake.
Can we just ask him about Dick Tracy? We'll love Dick Tracy.
Yeah.
Dick Tracy needs to be reappraised.
It does.
Potentially. Have you seen it recently?
No.
Okay.
God, no.
Yeah. I love Dick Tracy too, but one time I nearly cut myself with the pencil. Anyway, that's it from us for another week. Have a happy Easter, everybody. Whether or not you believe in benevolent bunnies bringing you chocolate eggs or not, until we meet again, it is goodbye from John.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from Nick.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from Phil.
Au revoir.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to get some sleep. I ordered some on Amazon. It should have arrived by now. See you next week. Bye.